Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. It is Tuesday, June the 17th, 2003. At this time, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 5029, Housing and Community Services Department.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee. This is the budget for the Housing and Community Services Department. We'll walk down through the memo that was distributed to your office yesterday, as we have done in the past.
You got an extra copy of that.
I do.
Somebody must have sure heard you walked off and left.
Anybody else need a copy?
Thank you.
Oh, you have yours?
Okay.
Check them.
First item, performance measures. Again, I've referenced where the performance measures can be found in the budget binder. I did attach to this memo a two-page summary of the performance measures. So for convenience of the subcommittee members, there are no specific concerns expressed during the subcommittee, during the public hearings by the subcommittee. And so LFO is recommending approval of the performance measures as submitted by the agency.
Any question about performance measures?
Sure, Mr. Chair. I'll move adoption of the performance measures as submitted by the agency.
Okay. Senator Dukes has recommended or proposed a motion that we accept the recommendations of the LFO relative to performance measures. Are there any questions? Comments? Without objection.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Moving on down on page two, we'll start going through the adjustments to the governor's budget. The first is the LFO adjustment package 001. This is for the salary freeze. This also, we reviewed vacant positions. The agency had a total of seven vacant positions. This eliminates one of those vacant positions, but leaves the funding to be used for other personal service line items and more accurately reflect where those funds are being used or have been used and will be used. And then moving down to package 002, these are the adjustments that are being made to all the agency budgets regarding the DAS assessment rate, the attorney general rate reduction, and then inflation reductions as well.
Senator Carter.
It's your pleasure to vote the policy items as given by LFO. What is your pleasure?
I think what we'll do is, unless we have any objections as we're going through,
okay.
We can, then we'll just move them all as one, if that's okay.
That's fine.
Okay, let's do that.
Okay. Now, starting down to the policy packages, the agency had several policy packages in their budget, in the governor's budget. Package 150, this is the HOPWA continuation. This is a federal grant for housing opportunities for people with AIDS. This provides federal money for these patients and citizens of the state outside the Portland area. This continues that grant. Four positions, 2.5 FTE is limited duration, and that grant concludes during the 03-05 biennium. And LFO is recommending approval of that package.
Rick, let me back up a little bit. I'm just having a look at this and realizing that these adjustments probably should be separated from policy packages.
That's what I was saying.
Thank you.
Okay.
Is that a motion?
Mr. Chairman, move that Senate adjustments be approved as per LFO's recommendation.
Senator Carter has moved that we accept the adjustments to the governor's balanced budget as in policy packages 001 and 002. Is there any further discussion? Questions? Without objection. Sorry about that.
Okay. Questions on package 150? Okay. We'll move down to package 151. this package in the governor's budget established a one position, which was is funded approximately 80% with federal funds to help address increased workload in the home program and also a reclassification of one clerical position, as has been consistent with the co-chair's plan and budget targets. LFO is recommending that the position be established as a limited duration position and that the position reclassification be denied.
Any questions about package 151? Representative Hansen.
What's the reasoning and rationale for the denial of the reclassification? Has it went through a formal reclassification process, or is the department just asking for the right?
At the time of the budget, it was had not gone through the formal process yet.
Okay, we will steady. Work session on House Bill 729, considering policy packages and other adjustments.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, I think when we left, we were discussing policy package 151. I think Representative Hansen had asked a question about reclasses. Part of the guiding principles that were given to us before the session started was to look at reclassifications and encourage agencies, instead of approving reclasses, to assign work duties within current classifications. And so as you go through here, you'll see a couple of packages where LFO is recommending denial of position reclassifications as is in package 151. I don't know if that answers your question.
Just in addition, to Rick, since I didn't quite hear it all, I apologize. But are these positions in terms of reclassification that you looked at, Rick, and found that the work, the source of the work is not above what the classification presently is?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, no. We did not have time to look at each position reclassification for those kinds of things. We're just taking the guiding principles that we were given and applying those to those packages.
So no reflection in terms of the department deeming this position being of a higher... Okay, got it.
We're encouraging the departments to assign work duties within existing classifications instead of... there's been some concern that position reclassifications in the past have been pretty easy to come by and liberal and not as much scrutiny as should be. But that judgment aside, we're recommending denial and encouraging agencies to assign duties within current classifications.
Senator,
do you mind if I ask Mr. Refine a question?
No, absolutely.
Mr. Refine. And no funny jokes either.
No comments about steaks either.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Started off already in the wrong foot.
This is what happens when they don't let us out of here.
That's exactly right. Sir, can you tell me what would be the effects in your department of positions that have been denied in terms of reclassification? Does it affect the ability to hire in that category? Is the workload of such that... Talk to me a little bit about that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. This particular position is a support staff person whose job has evolved over time. Probably at the time this individual was hired, or the job was fashioned based on the workload of what was going on and the responsibilities, it was probably appropriate. We're looking for the move to increase on classification because much of their activity now has been enhanced because of higher levels of reporting and data collection that they have to do for us. So that's our justification, that the job itself has changed. If, as Mr. Olson talks about, going back to try to figure out what fits within the parameters of the income, more than likely, my assumption is that certain things will have to either not be done by that person and or assigned to somebody else in some clever way, or just decide what priorities need to be accomplished with that job. So it's, in this case, because the work has changed dramatically since the job was originally put into service. The issues are, as anybody is this potentially, if this individual believes that their work skills are not being compensated at a fair and equitable rate, this person would have the right to go out and look for other jobs. So it does create some volatility in the job. Not to say that the person can't be replaced, but it does create some volatility in the job.
Thank you.
Representative Hanson.
Well, general comment. And I know reclassifications have been a real sore spot through a lot of budget work the last couple of sessions. The problem I have is that if the work, the pattern of the needed work has changed and there's more responsibility added to it or the various reasons why you go through a classification, and we arbitrarily say, well, to save money, keep doing things the way they were done originally, it gets us into a real micromanagement thing. If the job has evolved into something else, and for budgetary reasons, we say, no, do it the way you were doing it 4 years ago. And don't use that person with don't give them the extra responsibility or whatever. It's really not a good management technique. I mean, because still, the work needs to be done. People need to be compensated for the level of work, and when we're kind of arbitrarily saying drop back and don't do it in the way the department thinks is the most efficient way to get the work done, I think we're creating more problems. To save $2,000, and I don't know about this specific problem or specific position, maybe this is one that could actually might be beneficial. But I think it's better to leave that decision to the managers rather than at the level that we look at. But I think maybe it's something we need to discuss. If there are other positions, we can look at the whole pattern. I think that's kind of raising the issue.
Mr. Chairman, just a comment, just to qualify a couple things. In visiting with my staff, all four of the positions we had that were for reclass have had desktop audits. So that means that our human resource people have done an analysis of whether or not the job and their action of their job is appropriate to their salary. And so we've deemed that they are working in a higher level of product, which deserves an increase in their salaries. And then that information was sent to DAS, and DAS concurs that they were, you know, that would justify this. So it's not that we are just saying, for the sake of raising somebody's salary, we're going to raise it. There has been the audit to demonstrate this.
Senator Dukes, and then we'll come back to Senator.
Sure. Let me talk a little bit about why we're looking at these so carefully this session. And it has nothing to do with housing or with this particular position. But it came to our attention the last session when an agency had asked for a reclassification for someone into a position that the legislature had eliminated, deliberately eliminated. And so slowly they were giving the person work and more work, and then all of a sudden they said, I have an assistant deputy. And we had taken away the assistant deputy position. And so they went to DAS, and DAS said, yep, that's what that person's doing, all that work. Okay, you know, you've got a reclassification. And then I'll be darned when we reclass the person, you know what the new salary was? It was the same salary as the director was getting. So all of a sudden we had a director of an agency who was working out of class. And I couldn't understand how you ever got to an agency director working out of class. Well, it was because you couldn't have him working at the same amount, making the same amount as the assistant director. And so then they recommended that he get an increase too. And then it hit committee, and we just sort of said, no. Well, the end result was we denied it, and DAS approved it in the interim. And the director went on, and everything was just fine. I think he got back wages and everything. And we started questioning DAS about their review, and their review is very cursory. It's just what Mr. Reed Pine said it was. Are you doing the work in order to be, you know, to qualify for this position? Nobody asks, do we want that work done or do we want this position to exist? We are now, for the next 2 years, denying all wages increases and merit increases. And the only way to get a pay increase is through reclass in the next 2 years. And that's why that's why the co-chairs have put some emphasis on it, and we've been asked to put some emphasis on it. If we talk about this one, I mean, it's federal funds on top of everything else, so I might very well say this one, they make a good case, and this one's needed. But I would say be very careful, because we have some really creative people out there, and you're not going to have control of your budget if you let this one go.
not this one, but this issue.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, Senator Zeeb's answered my question, because my question was, are these general fund, in this particular category, are the general fund dollars? I know they're federal funds, but, and I do understand the co-chair's position, but when you have four positions in a department, and those are denied, that's why I was asking the questions. And I do understand, I'm not shooting a messenger, Mr. Olson, because I know you've been given directions from a co-chair. And so my question has also to do with my colleagues, and that is the whole issue of micromanagement. And if we bring employees in, and there's nothing worse than being denied a reclass, because I've gone through that myself as a professional counselor and doing part management and part counseling. And so I just have to say, no, you're going to hire you another manager, I'll stay in counseling rather than to do both of these jobs. And so it does become a dicey little issue, but it certainly is worse in terms of morale to have people working above the classifications in which they're being paid, and it's not good for the people that are working on the job. You know, like, why the hell should I work any harder when you're not going to pay me more and I'm not going to be recognized for this? And so it's a worthiness issue, value judgment kind of thing. But thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just to get some balance in there, and Senator Dukes is correct as to some of the concern and the fact that we are in a completely different budget environment. But this morning, talking to one of our partners at the county level, in a certain area, they had lost, there have been 1,000 county employees who have lost their jobs. Okay? And the question that was asked of me is, what are you doing at the state level to make sure you control the cost of the state-run part of these programs? Because so many times what's happening, the people who actually address the needs of our constituents are the people at the local level as we farm these up. And it may not be applicable here, but we also have to maintain fairness. They're demanding of us that if we're in one little category of employment within county government, we're laying off 1,000 people. What are you doing to get your costs under control at the state level? And so I think that's one of these somewhat symbolic statements of, listen, everybody's got to suck it up right now until we get through this recession. Yeah. I'm going to ask the committee, would you guys prefer to vote on each one of these packages?
I think we don't come back.
Chairman, I'm satisfied in block.
Okay. All right. Let's go ahead. Any further questions about 151?
Okay, moving on to package 152. This establishes a program technician 2 position for monitoring housing development projects, including farm worker housing projects. LFO is recommending approval of the package, but establishing the position has limited duration. That would simply mean that the agency would have to come back during the next budget cycle and ask for the position again. And depending on the state of the economy and the guiding principles to establish the budget at that time, we will relook at the position then.
Senator Duke?
Is this, what kind of funds is this?
Can I tell you that?
What kind of other?
Mr. Chair, committee members, this is our resources that we earn from the housing contract administration that we do. So it's other funds generated by another activity within our building.
Sir, if I could, do we think this is a position that we're going to want to have go away? I mean, as an agency director, is this a position that you're just trying out for a couple of years?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, actually, this is a position that has been asked of us by our partners. It's an accountability issue. We have, since 1991, we've administered the Oregon Housing Trust account, which is, you know, the corpus. I know you know the history of that. But in the process of using those resources, there is a compliance issue for services. So in today's environment, when somebody uses the dollars that are set aside by the trust account, you as an applicant agree to offer certain levels of services to your constituents or your residents. And those services could be everything from handy-dandy maps of where the transit is and where the Meals on Wheels location might be, or it could include those plus in including GED training on the premises, Spanish as a second language, computer labs. We've had people, because we've never monitored that, we've never said, have we or are we getting the services that were promised by the people over the last 10 years. Now, anecdotally, we believe we get the services. But some of the earlier ones that came through the pipeline, you know, their populations have changed, their mind gets a little foggier, they have new management people, and so their service component may not be as bright or as brisk as it should be. And so the idea behind this was to be able to have somebody working within those parameters, and then along with our farm worker activities, to make sure that the partners who have received resources from us are living up not only to the housing component that they've agreed to, but also the service components that we think that are extremely important, which is also to say that in 10 years the population may have changed, and so the service components that they were offering to 10 years ago may not be the service components they should have today. So we would go back in there and try to work with them to make sure that the service units, the components they're offering today, do meet the population needs that they have. So it's something we've been wanting to do. We've just not ever been able to get that position filled.
So your partners want this and your partners are paying for it?
I would say that, well, the people who are paying for it is from a federal compliance program that we're participating in. So I don't think it's the same partner. But external partner, we've had people say, you know, I know that so-and-so a project is not doing their service components, and why are you giving me a hard time when I know they're not doing it? And so we're not in the, we don't have a position to go out there and police that.
Is this federal money that you think will continue?
As it stands right now, it appears to be an ongoing process. This is part of the government, the federal government's approach to decentralizing and offering property management to the states or administration of reviewing HUD projects that they currently had in their portfolio but did a very poor job doing over time. I mean, some projects were never reviewed. So they gave them to states or a larger reviewing organization such as ourselves and said, go out and do great things. And if we do the compliance right, we get it in on time, and we don't get nicked too many for noncompliance on the report, we actually pick up a percentage of a bonus point, and that money is what we use to pay for this compliance person. So it's because of our work, our asset property management people's good work, that we would be able to fund this.
Mr. Chair, we're always talking about trying to get services out to the public.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my question is, why do we want to just do this limited duration? It sounds like the funding is there, and the need is there, and it sounds like it does something good. So I'm just asking the question.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I can tell you again, going back to those guiding principles that we were given before the session started, we had to look closely at any request for new positions. And the other part of that is the public perception. And there are those members that are concerned about the public perception and the idea that the legislature is growing government. And by creating positions, you're growing government. You're growing the state government. This is somewhat of a compromise in between the establishing a permanent position or not establishing a position at all. And again, this is a position that will be established for the next 2 years, and then the situation, the economy, all that will be taken into consideration during the next legislative session when we renew the budget again. And again, if the economy is better and things are looking up, perhaps that would be the time to establish it as a permanent position.
If I can, Mr. Chair, the people who worry about growing government don't make the distinction between a limited duration and a permanent position. They only know that we've created another position, and the economy isn't going to affect this one. This isn't an Oregon-based source of funding, and so, I mean, I guess I'll take it either way, but it just seems to me that if you ask the public if they wanted us to accept the federal or put the federal money into something that would make sure that low-income people were getting the services that they had been promised, they'd probably say yes. So.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, we have been repeatedly reminded that regardless of the fund source, it's still taxpayer.
Oh, I know, but then they told us that the subcommittees were supposed to make the decision, so here I am.
Well, I can let everyone know that if, in fact, the economy does not improve, we may not need to worry about farm worker housing, because there's going to be a lot of farmers that are going to be closing their doors and walking away. So I think that's an important consideration. The other thing is, we might find out we don't have a problem out there with compliance, and so it seems really reasonable to me a limited duration might in fact reflect what the person in the limited time period that we've established here would in fact find out. So Representative Smith. Okay.
Well, we also find, and if you don't mind me, I have to express myself.
You can.
Thank you.
I just did.
Because I'm like some of your dupes. I don't see why the hell you need a subcommittee if we're going to be rubber stamping everything that goes along. We either wanted a subcommittee with some level of power to make some decisions before these people let everybody go to the big committee and be through with it. Thank you.
This could be a long budget.
This could be a long budget. Rick and I said yesterday, this will be an easy one. We're doing this. What were we doing yesterday? All right, any further questions on 152? Okay, package 153.
Moving on to package 153.
Moving on slowly.
This package establishes another position to coordinate homeless programs. The LFO recommendation, again, is to approve the position as limited duration. There is a slight reduction of a little over $1,000 here, and that simply reflects the change in the Attorney General rates in this package.
Any questions on 153? 154.
Okay, package 154 provides other fund limitation for expenses related to the Hunger Relief Task Force. And then it provides federal funds limitation for the Community Development Block Grant funds. And LFO is recommending approval of this package as contained in the governor's balanced budget.
Okay. Any questions, comments on 154?
No.
Okay. Moving on to package 156. This package requests to establish six new positions. Three compliance specialist positions, which are currently limited duration positions. The package also included the establishment of an office specialist, an administrative specialist, and a principal executive manager position. And then again, it included three reclassifications of three positions. The LFO recommendation is to approve the three compliance specialist positions and continue them as limited duration as they currently are, but deny the establishment of the other three positions, and then also deny the reclass of the three positions.
Any questions on 156?
Quick question.
Yes.
Well, I'd like to hear from the department on how that changes your ability to do the job that need to do.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, if you're talking about the property asset management people, compliance people,
yeah,
those positions, as in anything, as every year we exist, we take on more projects or developments for our portfolio, and so the growth is continuum within our agency. So as every year we go on, it just gets bigger. What we are doing is similar to, we try to do the best on case management that we can. We've tried to facilitate people who will go out to certain areas, so there's their familiarity with both the projects and the geographical area where they're in, so they're not just flying all over the state from one corner to the next. It does increase the caseload for them. You got to realize the compliance time window is not 12 months a year. It's really, particularly in the eastern side of the state, we can only travel. Generally, we try not to travel over there in the inclement weather because of potential of risks. So there's a window of time that allows for our compliance officers to do their work. So it will become an issue still. We'll just have to be managing, you know, just those increases as to the staffing that we currently have.
Follow-up,
and this is probably more to Rick. Of the roughly $600,000 of other in federal funds that we're saving, how are we redeploying that money? $600,000.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, that money is not being used anywhere else. That would continue to accumulate into the accounts of the Housing Community Development or Services Department. It's just the limitation that's being decreased here.
So would that, the net effect mean that that would increase ending balances, or would there be more money available for other projects? Or?
Could be both, particularly for the other fund.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair George. On these compliance specialists, those are positions that are used to go out into the communities and ensure that grant and loan dollars are being used in appropriate manner and that the terms and conditions of the agreements are being met.
That's correct.
Follow.
Mm-hmm.
The tape stopped. I just want to make it very clear to this committee that these types of positions are what ensure the return of the money back to the state of Oregon to generate additional interest earnings to revolve back into the community to perpetuate these programs. And so if we're going to eliminate or not approve the positions that go with this type of requirement, we all need to serve notice on ourselves that in 2 years, if they come back and say that their delinquency rates have increased or that their noncompliance on grants has increased, that we're not pointing the finger at them, but rather looking in a mirror. Because as a person who manages loan portfolios, it's very important to make sure that the terms and conditions of these agreements are met. And when you begin to give a couple inches, it's amazing how a couple miles are taken. So, my thought for the day.
Senator Dukes?
Why, again, are we recommending not to approve these three?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, again, just to be clear, the LFO recommendation is to approve the compliance specialist position,
right,
but not approve the what has been referred to as administrative positions, the clerical positions.
And Chair, I truly respect the work that staff has done and the co-chairs, and I fully support that. I just wanted to be very clear to this subcommittee the implication that comes from the environment that we're in.
Chair, if I could, my question was really why we were denying that, those three.
I'm not sure how to answer why, other than LFO and the co-chairs and developing the entire budget for the entire department didn't feel that these three were necessary.
Mr. Chairman, if I could. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I understand Mr. Olson's hesitance to answer that question, but there has been, I mean, as in all fairness to LFO and to the agency, we believe that there has been a very strong open dialogue about all these positions, and we had a lot of positions we were asking for. I think the number in total is 28, and, you know, that's enough to roll my numbers back and my eyes back in my head. And through a very specific process of figuring out which are the ones we needed to have and which ones that they felt that they could advocate for us on. We, you know, this list is a culmination of that activity. So I'm not saying to any of the members that I'm not asking for you to have other sympathetic eyes or ears to this, but the reality is that there has been a tremendous amount of, at least in this budget, I can't speak to all the budgets, but I think Mr. Olson has worked very well with the staff to try to find that common ground that is going to allow us to operate. Even though we are limited durations, it's better than no positions and allows us to perform the tasks that we can do. And we can come back and argue and articulate why there's opportunities to improve it. Again, not to say that anybody who's been advocating for the either permanent positions or improving positions is wrong. I'm just saying, just so the committee knows that there's a, you know, this is unsolicited, I might add. There has been a lot of discussion in this budget, particularly in preparation for this, because we did have a lot of positions, and we wanted to figure out how we could get the best of what we were going to get so we could use them to our best interest, and I think we've accomplished that in this document, quite frankly.
Thank you, Chair, if I could. I appreciate that, Mr. Repine. And putting budgets together is not easy, and you as a former co-chair know that probably better than anybody else in the room. But what I'm pretty sure has happened here is that there was a meeting, probably several meetings, those behind-closed-door meetings that none of us were privy to, except perhaps for the subcommittee chair, and the decisions were made that you could have some. So unless you want to tell me that you asked for positions in this budget that you didn't need, then I don't think that's where you're headed. Then I guess this is another one of those. We're told we're supposed to work the budgets, and we're told we're supposed to do what's good for Oregon. It's not general fund. It's other funds and federal funds, and the money's just going to go sit there. So I don't know. I mean, if somebody wanted to tell me that it was building up the housing trust fund or it was helping the food bank or something like that, I'd say those are good things. But that's not what's going on here. It's just going to sit there because somebody made an arbitrary decision that in this budget we could only increase so many positions and we couldn't go above that regardless of what they did. And so this is about the third arbitrary decision I've seen in this budget, and I'm just about at my fill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Dukes. Is the money going to just sit there?
If it's, Mr. Chairman, committee members, if the assumption that these are resources that it wouldn't be used for other activities in housing, if they're federal funded programs, more than likely it will just sit there, yes.
Well, yeah, that pretty much answers my question, too.
Senator Carter, and back to
representation. Could you please know, I'm going to set the record straight one time, even with Mr. Repine and the chair. This is not about you.
Oh absolutely.
Good. Now, I'm saying this because Mr. Repine said, we have worked very hard with Mr. Olson to try to clarify the positions as if it's no reflection on him. You're darn right it's not. I came here with 144,000 people who sent me here. Nobody else sent me here but them. And it's my own decision to question. And it's back to what Senator Duke said. Do you mean to tell me you asked for 29 positions, Mr. Repine, that you did not need, and you filled our time for nothing in asking for those positions?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, no, that's not what I was saying. Actually, we have, as in all budget presentations, have demonstrated the need and the requirement of those 28
so
positions.
So I thought. Another question, Mr. Repine. Of the 29 positions that you originally requested, how many did you get?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, we've received 5. Oh, excuse me, 25.
25.
You know you got hell, no, Roger.
25. I almost, I'm glad we stopped you there because that would have been.
Based on that?
Hi, Mr. McKay. Go for it.
No, thank you.
So we have, for the record, it's 25.
Mr. Chairman, I guess to the committee members, my point I was trying to raise is that as frustrating as this is, as we all know, my staff, who I have a great degree of comfort and confidence in, as Mr. Olson represents the legislative fiscal process, we have to, you know, our decision was made as a mutual level. So there wasn't this is you're going to take it and you're going to lock it. It was, we came to a mutual consensus of what it is. I'm not saying that it's the right consensus, but it is a mutual consensus.
Yeah, but then you put it in our hands.
I understand. Yeah. That's why you get paid the big bucks.
Yeah. Is Greg making all that money over
here? Moving right along. Any further questions on policy package 156.
Okay, moving on to package 157. This is the package that continues or allows the department to continue to fulfill the obligations under the HUD contract for monitoring HUD projects. This package was requested to continue 14.41 FTE. They are currently limited duration. The request was to continue them as limited duration, and LFO is recommending approval of that package with no changes.
Okay. Any questions about package 157? Package 158.
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, package 158 provides limitation for the department for expenditures related to their office move. They are scheduled to move into the new North Mall office building. Latest I heard was September. I don't know if they're still on schedules. So LFO is recommending approval of the package.
Okay.
Then moving on to package 003, you may recall that during the budget hearings, there was some discussion about the Community Incentive Fund, which were the lottery-backed bonds proceeds. There was a little over $5 million of those proceeds that were not spent, and the subcommittee was concerned about how those monies were going to be used. And in fact, the subcommittee requested that the department not use those and not disperse those, and in fact use those for housing-related projects or other projects or programs administered by the department. There were a couple of programs that were specifically identified, and it was later discovered that those funds could not be used for the statewide homeless assistance program and other programs. And so in consultation with the department, we sat down. Actually, the department came up with a recommendation on how to accomplish the same thing. And this package makes those adjustments to accomplish that. It transfers $5.53 million from the Housing Trust Fund to the General Fund to help resolve the statewide budget issue. And then it sets out a method in which the interest from the Community Incentive Fund dollars can be used to help repay that Housing Trust Fund. And then also in the co-chair's budget, as it was released, made some other adjustments. It reduced the housing and development guarantee account by $1.7 million, general fund. It reduced partial general fund support for the Commission for Voluntary Action and Services. It eliminates the general fund support for the community development corporations and reduces general fund from the emergency housing account, and that amount would be backfilled from the Housing Finance Fund. Because the remaining $5 million of lottery bonds that was authorized will not be issued, the budget is also reduced by $730,000 lottery funds for the debt service that was originally built into the budget but will not occur now because of that $5 million in lottery bonds will not be issued. I do have one change to those numbers that you see there on the right. The federal funds, the last number, instead of the $7,310,000 reduction, it should only be a $2,300,000 reduction. Because there is some monies left for the Commission for Voluntary Action and Services, just under $50,000, they'll be able to use that, and they'll have some federal dollars coming in, and that little over $5 million will be the federal dollars coming in for that commission. So that number changes slightly.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. Director Repine, how many community development corporations are receiving general fund support?
Mr. Chairman, the Representative Smith, as I just heard from my good ear, it sounds like 20 of the CDCs around the state of Oregon are receiving supplements or resources from the general fund.
So with the reduction of $218,000, what's going to be the impact on these community development corporations and their ability to provide the services at the local level?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, I think as you know and most members here realize that community development corporations are a very intricate part of the state's infrastructure for not only housing issues but other community service-based deliverables. They can be found in everything from children relief centers to nurseries to coalitions for kids, one-stop shops,
education.
Yeah, there's a variety of, they exist in a variety of formats. what we use these resources with them on is to get some distribution around the state so they can get some assistance relative to either operational activities or administration activities, because community development corporations are nonprofit by nature. They try not to pad or put any extra costs on any of their projects or developments they're involved in, so they work very close to the bottom of the pocket lining, and resources they would prefer to put them through the programs instead of to their pockets. So this will have a change on them. Now there are other resources that we match with this. They're federal resources, but this is $200,000 out of a process that I think we had valued. If you look at our original prioritization, we had valued this as one of those strong pieces of keeping consistent within the state during these economic times. Is to be you just never know what will be the piece that takes them over the top. And my suspicions there is that you will see possibly some consolidations of CDCs where there's multiple ones in geographical areas, or the demise of some because they just financially won't be able to keep their doors open.
I don't mean to offend by this comment if I offend folks. This is kind of like the hunter going out into the woods to go hunting, and he has all of his equipment, his shiny new boots, he's got his bullets, has everything he needs, but now he doesn't have a rifle. He doesn't have the tool to go out and actually get the job done. And these community development corporations provide a very, very valuable role, I think an irreplaceable role, in providing these services, because they're in the communities, they're attending the chambers of commerce, they're at the community colleges, they're working with the businesses, they're working with the vulnerable folks. And for us to take the money away from them, the people who are providing the service, while we're trying to maintain these other programs, to me, doesn't make a tremendous amount of sense. I understand the environment we're in. I don't like it, but to me it just doesn't make sense. So,
Senator Carter.
You might want to take this one out because I'm a no vote on this one.
Independence.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Repine, what's the impact of the $5.5 million transfer from the trust fund to the general fund? What will be the impact over the next two bienniums as the money's being repaid, and what's the impact of this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'll make an attempt at this, and then Mr. Krager will kick me to the table or just pull away the mic from me. But the way it's envisioned is that these resources that we have from the incentive fund money will be pushed into the housing trust account. Then you'll pick out the equivalent amount in general fund to be used as you choose to, or the legislature chooses to use it. The amount of money that'll be going in there will not totally replace the full value of the trust account as it's being taken out, but over time, and the time lapse could be as far as like 2008, as those loans that we've already have out there. We have two rounds out there now of incentive funds. As those loans are repaid, now the grants are gone, but the loans are repaid, we will dump those back into the trust account. So it will replenish itself over time, and it could go out as far as 2008. But we think it's better than having just a loss of money, quite frankly. I mean, as opposed to just taking the trust account and saying now it's a hole. At least we've created a vehicle that will replenish it over time, and the time could be such that it could happen quickly. I mean, if the loans repay earlier than they're supposed to be, they could be repaid earlier.
Senator Moore.
Now he'll give you the real answer.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Rick Krager, Chief Financial Officer for the Department. Representative Hansen, I guess to answer your question, the Housing Trust Fund, the way it works now is the $15.5 million corpus generates interest earnings, and those interest earnings are used for housing development grants. What will happen during that period of time and that we're trying to rebuild it is that won't happen. essentially the interest earnings that are made on the corpus and the community incentive fund will be recycled back to build back to that $15.5 million corpus. So to answer your question short and sweet, what is the impact? We are essentially not going to be able to use about $600,000 to $700,000 of biennial interest earnings for housing development grants.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, just however, there is we still have resources that come into the trust account vis-a-vis the power dereg bill of Senate Bill 1149. So those are resources that will be there to help supplement or augment the lack of the interest that's going to be accruing off the corpus.
Yes.
Well,
I guess where my angst on this is, this is the same agency that supports the Hunger Relief Task Force, that handles hunger issues, and I'm, this is a little bit of a stretch here, but be a little bit patient. We've had a variety of bills introduced that needed a little bit of general fund that could have dramatically impacted hunger in the state. Now we're taking $5 million from this agency for general fund purposes, but yet I can't get budget hearings on a couple hunger bills that would need $50,000 in general fund and probably impact a significant amount of leverage, significant amount of federal dollars. I'm talking about a couple of the WIC coupon bills. And it just seems to me that we're going at a time that we don't have overall resolution of the big picture budget issues in terms of where we're going to find new revenue. We haven't revenue packages moving. There's no leadership agreement in terms of where the overall budget is going. I don't know if I can support, well, I know I can't support taking $5 million from a housing agency to put into the general fund when a lot of other needs of low-income people aren't being met. So I won't be able to support this package, and I assume it's a pretty integral part of the overall budget.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for Rick. Can we take savings out of package 156 and apply them to 003? $156 has no impact on the fund. Can they be applied to, for example, in the discussion on community development corporations?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I don't believe so because that other fund money that is being saved in 156, my understanding is that's not able to be used for the community development corporations. And the department may want to address that, clarify that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, Rick said it exactly right. I mean, the dollars that we're talking about that are saved within package 156 are restricted in terms of being able to, you know, we're kind of back to our same problem again and trying to find a way to use money that is restricted and revise it. I mean, this is essentially what we've done in this case with the community incentive fund. So those dollars would be restricted and not be eligible to use for that.
Further questions or comments on package 003? Senator Carter, did you want to speak?
I'm fine, Mr. Chairman. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, we're in a position where we're going to need to vote on these. We're going to have two of our members back here shortly, I believe. On the assumption that we will have an in-block vote on 150, 151, 152, 153, 54, 56, 57, 58, and 003, I've already heard a couple of no votes here. Where do we stand on these?
Mr. Chairman, so that sort of Duke can be back to support your motion on this, and so that Senator Representative Smith can be back, you'd lose your package, so you might want to extrapolate 003 out and wait until those guys come back, because I don't have a problem
I just had questions and statements, but I don't have a problem with the others.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, Mr. Chairman, what is talking your motion?
Senator, hang on. I think what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3276 and, on House Bill 5029 and open up a work session on House Bill 3276. I'm watching the time up there. And,
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, House Bill 3276 is the vehicle by which necessary statutory language change to implement Package 003.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm guessing at this point if you've got problems, or we might have problems with Package 003.
Right.
We may not want to move on this one either. So. But that's what it does. And I got a copy of the amendment.
And that's why we're there.
The Dash 3 amendment. And I'll hand those out. Exactly. This is the necessary language.
The phone call for representative.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, what this language does, it allows department to use interest to pay back the housing trust fund that is described in Package 003 of the budget. There were some necessary statute changes that had to be done to accomplish that. House Bill 3276, the original bill that came out of the substantive committee, creates a provision that allows the Housing and Community Services Department to provide loans for lots included in mobile home dwelling parks. And so the Dash 3 amendment provides the language to implement the budget portion of Package 003 in the budget.
Okay, Representative Krepp is asked to address us relative to additional amendments. Go ahead and tell us about
it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Representative Jeff Cuff from House District 17, and this is a concept that I have hit upon after, frankly, listening to a number of my constituents who are elderly and live in long-established, what I refer to as mobile home parks in this state. And one of the issues is some years ago, the legislature, in its wisdom, passed a law that facilitates tenants being able to purchase their parks. There hasn't been a whole lot of that's occurred over the years, frankly. Mr. Repine can share with us about a circumstance that he's put together just recently on this particular subject. Initially, the bill didn't quite do what it wanted, what I really wanted it to do, and so we proposed the amendments. The latest amendment, the Dash 5, that I've just handed to you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and I think I have additional copies of it here if you need them, but basically moves the implementation of this process and this idea to become operative July 1st, 2005. And the basic idea is this, is that we would use tobacco settlement money to establish a revolving loan fund, not a grant, but a revolving loan fund to tenants of parks that are having some difficulty in obtaining traditional financing
for the purchase of their facility. And this is important. And the reason I chose the Tobacco Settlement Fund, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, is because I believe there are a number of I think it's a credible nexus to utilize these dollars for this purpose, and I'll tell you why. Is because I believe there are a number of folks who live in these mobile home parks who are partly debilitated because of the effects of smoking. Now, this is not a stretch of the imagination, because behind me sitting in the audience is a lady who has been very active in this particular issue, Pat Swan, and she, in fact, was a smoker, was on oxygen, living in one of these parks. And you will find that while they may not be the majority of the individuals that are living in these types of circumstances, it is clear that many of these folks are suffering from the effects of what was then considered to be a generationally accepted issue in terms of social smoking. So I felt this was frankly, knowing that we were going to have budget circumstances that were going to be difficult to deal with, there was not going to be any amount of money available anywhere. Yes, sir.
Representative Krebs, we need to ask a question.
Yes, sir.
I ask you to come up and address some potential amendments. What amendment are we talking about right now?
Actually, the twos.
Two and five.
And the fives, five. Yes.
Okay.
The twos and the fives. Do members of the committee have a copy of the twos?
Three.
They're getting them right
now.
They're
going to get twos right now.
I do not have copies of the five.
Three, we ready to move.
Copies of five?
I have a couple here, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I'll pass that down to you guys. We'll just kind of share what we have.
Share this.
And I think what we'll do, thanks. Representative Hanson, you guys have a flashlight.
This is yours. Okay. So anyway, Mr. Chair, the concept was is tobacco settlement dollars that are coming to this state is over 20-year periods, well over $2 billion. And it appears in this particular difficult funding circumstances that those dollars are being utilized in many different forms for many different things. And I think that, frankly, this is a fair nexus to draw the correlation between folks who live in these types of circumstances that have lived there for many years. They're very low income in many cases, and frankly, the effects of smoking have damaged them physically in their health. And in many cases, this is all they have. And I tell you a personal story, Mr. Chair, is I lived in a manufactured housing park in California for 2 years in the mid-80s. And one of the problems that happens, as we have seen the increase in land values over the years, some of the owners have decided to sell their parks. They've sold them in a pure business circumstance. The new owner needs to raise rents to cover the investment that they've made to get a return on their investment. And that places many of these individuals who are in poor health, some again due to smoking, that have lived in these parks some places for 30 years. It places them at an extreme disadvantage because they're on fixed incomes. And so what is the choice? Well, the choice is they go through all of their savings, and their home, that little small manufactured home, is the last thing they have. It's it. And in some cases, they have to give that up. And then they become wards of the state. And they move into a long-term care facility where the rest of us taxpayers pick up the tab for that. And it seems to me that this is a fair concept. That much as we do with Project Independence, we believe it's important and correct to keep people in their homes as long as they can, because it's proven to save the state money. I would say that this is also a similar concept here. So the idea is that we're going to take $25 million of tobacco settlement money and not do away with it, but use it as a revolving loan fund. And let those dollars be repaid to by park owners as the tenants become the owners of their parks. They manage them themselves, and they repay those dollars. And I've chosen to run this again through Bob Repine's agency, because I think that They're already involved in this process. I think that they're well suited to manage this revolving loan program.
Senator Carter.
Representative Kupfer, this is a great idea, and I think it's certainly worthy of being brought to this committee. But I'd like to ask Mr. Reed a question. Is there, and I'm asking him this question because I think that there is the art of diminishing return. And while tobacco settlement dollars are doing everything in general fund that you can think of, this concept is such a great one. I'm wondering if Mr. Repound, we could accomplish this in some other manner, and so that we won't have to deal with the potential of diminishing return in dollars and have a more secured way of doing it. What do you, can you think of some other way that this can be
Mr.
done?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, I think what I hear you saying is because the I think you're talking about the tobacco settlement, and it's I mean it's obviously an opportunity, but we see a lot of people drawing it from a variety of ways. The only piece that, and again, I think the representative made a good argument for the logic of his promoting this of this amendment. The only one I could probably see that you, is a stretch again, because not knowing how it fits into the larger general fund revenue picture of the state budget you're working on, is I know there has been rumor or talk about the changing the tax reforms for second home ownership, which, if I remember correctly, raises about $47 million on a biennium or something like that. You know, whether or not it would be the same concept in using those resources, which then you can make probably a closer correlation between housing and housing costs. You're having people who have financial ability to have two homes help supplement or acquire and maintain affordability for those people who are not as fortunate. I think that's probably a compelling story to talk about, too. It might be a tie, but I don't know how all those pieces fit together relative to what the Revenue Committee is doing and the Ways and Code Chairs are doing. But, you know, it's a source, and I think the representative has made a pretty strong argument because there is. I mean, you will find the majority of the people who are in the number of, I think there's something in excess of probably 68 or 70,000 people in park settings around the state of Oregon. You'll probably find the great percentage of them are seniors. And are faced with that day-to-day issue that the representative is talking about is what does their future hold based on how many times the property gets turned over or sold underneath them. And any buyer will pay just about anything for one because the asset has no limit on what you can charge the people for sitting on the ground. So if I want to spend more than anybody else does, all I've got to do is functionally figure out a way to roll up the rents to cover my cost of my debt and what I expect on the return of my money. So it is kind of a very, you know, strange market environment. And what happens, just so you know, committee members, in a we put together one park deal the representative mentioned, and it was a very difficult deal. It took over 2 years to do. And what you have still at the end of the day, you have the willingness of a mortgage or a lender to lend to a certain percentage of it. But between what they'll lend and what the property is for sale for, there's usually a gap. And that gap is then has to be paid for by somebody. And generally, we're talking about gaps in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so if you then take that gap and try to share that amongst everybody who's a participant in 100 park facilities, not all of them are going to have the money. So now all of a sudden, what do you do? So what they did in this particular park, they sold shares. So what has happened, yes, the park has been maintained as an affordable park, but only a portion of those that are residents in the park own shares. And what happens, and I know Pat's, I think I'm going to say this right, if I remember correctly, the way the deal was cut, those people who are residents who own shares are able to control their rents and create some rent certainty, but those people who haven't bought into as shareholders have a different rent scale. Is that correct, Pat? So you basically create a conflictive process with even the park. I mean, tenants are really family, but when 20 of them are willing to buy it because they have the money and the other 80 can't, the 20 then control the whole process. And so they've invested their money, and their return on their money says that we want to make sure our rents don't go over X amount.
then they're faced with that enjoyable task of saying, but in order to pay this debt, we're going to have to shift it to these other 80 people. But they will own it in the sense that there'll be more certainty that it's not going to get sold out from underneath them. So that big gap is the biggest is the issue. And we don't have the money that was set up in 1991 by the park acquisition bill that was floated back when Representative Peterson was with us. Only ever garnered, I think, around $400,000 in total. And at that time, that probably seemed like a big amount of money, but that doesn't even make the down payment on one of these multi-million-dollar parks. And that's the issue that we're faced against.
Mr. Chairman, this is such an excellent idea. I have a lot of mobile homes in my district. And it's a very sad commentary how many people are now looking for some housing situation because some of them are being required to pay more than 30% of their limited income for housing. So this is really an excellent idea. I was just wondering how else can we look at other sources for dollars because, you know, it's around this place, it's all in the air about tobacco settlement. It just seems to me to be a fund that everybody wants to use it. It might not be any there for low-income park ownership, for park ownership for low-income families. So if we could just think about some other source along with that, I'm for it. I'd like to see this bill go forward, but I'm just trying to think about another source.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Very similar views to Senator Carter. I think there's a lot of merit to the idea. The questions I have is, one, the cash flow from the master tobacco settlement. I know we bonded it for last session, or during one of the special sessions, mm-hmm. we bonded it out a long period of time. I don't know whether the anticipated cash flow would allow $25 million. And I think that's something that we've obviously got to clarify. The other one is, since these deals are so difficult to put together, in terms of what's the right sizing that you would think that you'd need in that, since this isn't started until 2005, I think we'd want to think a little bit about what's the appropriate size of the amount in short resources for that biennium. There's no use in putting $25 million into a revolving fund if maybe there's only going to be three deals come forward that only need $4.5 million. The other question is probably more global, and at some point you have to vote with your heart rather than your head. But one of the problems I've seen with particularly one of the large parks in my district, as you say, correctly pointed out, the land value has increased dramatically. There's a lot of money to be made on selling these at very inflated prices. The people that causes real problems for are elderly tenants that have lived there a long time and are trying to struggle on very limited means because they're 30 years past retirement and there's their incomes are based on Social Security, maybe from a spouse that worked during the 50s. So there needs to be subsidy. Somehow society needs to come up with a subsidy to help these people stay in their homes. But the question is, are we using public funds to subsidize very inflated real estate prices and profits of the people that are selling these? And are we going to create a system where almost anybody can put any dollar value on a mobile home park, and then the state comes in and subsidizes the cost of helping out the tenants that are now being given the burden of having to pay for very, very inflated prices of the land that their mobile home sits on? And I don't know if we ever can figure out a way to protect the public and stuff from that happening. Maybe we've got to just bite the bullet and stand up and say this is something that happens in a free market society, but yet we as kind of the helpers of last resort are going to be the people who are going to help subsidize this when it happens. But I can support this, but I need some answers on the mechanics of it. The other question would be is if we're going to be using convention, if the homeowner associations that are buying these parks are using conventional mortgage amounts, do we really need the whole $25 million, or can we get by with significantly less if we just need the gap funding to cover what can't be backed by the security of the property?
Quickly, Mr. Chairman, to represent Hansen's issues. First of all, as far as the purchase of it, I think that's not as big of an issue as you might think, because as we would again enter into an agreement with a park group or whoever might be considering this, we would be looking at appraised market values. We would not Blue Sky would show up in the appraised value, but it wouldn't be over the top. And so, you know, as financial investors, we would not pay anything more than what we think is a fair appraised value and something reasonable to that. It also would have to show on a cash flow basis, and you can assess that based on what the competition is charging for. I mean, you couldn't artificially say, well, they're going to get more money, which is going to double the rents, because nobody's going to pay that. It's just people will walk out. I mean, there's a limit to what people will accept, even though it's probably been already pushed to the extent today, but there is only a limit. And so I think you can hit the market pretty close. As far as the resource, I would tell you that the amount of money is an anomaly because we don't know. We've never had it available. I contend there's parks selling all the time. I mean, we have, I think, Pat, do we have 168 parks or 100? How many parks do we have?
How many parks do we have? We have
1,500 parks that meet what they call the park criteria, which I think is at least up to 5 units in facilities. So that's a lot of parks. And if I'm not mistaken, in talking with Pat and other people, there is a huge amount of those that are on the marketplace on a regular basis. So you could walk through $25 million, perceivably, very quickly, and depending on what the market is doing. So it's kind of hard to say, is it $2 million or $25 million? I contend, based on the volume of the stuff we saw, this Capoose deal, which was a 170-unit park, and it sold for $5.5 million. You can see it wouldn't take too many of Scoopoose-type parks where you would burn through $500,000 or $600,000 of gap filling.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a whole bunch of questions. The reference to, if I may.
Certainly.
The reference to lots in the Dash 2 amendments does not reference parks. I'm wondering if the distinction in terms of using these potential funds to purchase parks as opposed to lots, individual homeowner buyers, I think the representative Krupp, it would appear your intent was to assist homeowners, not investors in parks.
Mr. Chair and Senator Morse, yes, it is my intention that the Tenants Association who actually reside there would be able to use these dollars to help them obtain the financing that they need to purchase from the current owner. So it's meant for the tenants.
As a park unit, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, and not the sale of individual lots within a park.
Mm-hmm. I had the same question when I read it last night.
If you could connect the dots so the picture's a little clearer. This bill, as it was originally drafted, appears to just expand the availability of state loan guarantees to include manufacturing parks. Did this bill come out of a committee, and it's now come to a policy committee, and it's now come to Ways and Means, and now we're considering new amendments? If you could give us just a little bit of a genesis of the bill, it would help me understand what our task is here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Morse. The bill basically was moved at my request to Ways and Means because the committee, the standing committee, policy committee it was in was shutting down, and they weren't going to have an opportunity. They were not going to have time to hear it. So, in essence, this is not only the practical discussion, but it's also the policy discussion, because we simply have not had this.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, it was sent here. My staff said referred by the committee without recommendation, so it just was to get it out of the committee for the purpose of the committee shutting down.
And Mr. Chair, if I could indulge the chair to invite Pat to make a comment.
Yes. My name is Pat Schwach, and I represent manufactured homeowners. We're the people who represent the people who live in these parks. And I sat back here thinking, my God, I could be dead with this conversation going on. since we're the ones who are most definitely affected by all of this. And just a couple of things I'd like to cite. Representative Kropp's correct. I smoked for 62 years, and I feel like I've got a part in that miserable tobacco settlement, but that's another story. We came from a park, as Senator George knows, in Newburgh that 3 years ago was up for sale, and we attempted to buy it with Housing and Community Services. This was a full-blown something that nobody'd really gotten involved in before. And we encountered several problems, one of which was that everybody who lived in the park had to be at or below the poverty level, and anybody that wasn't was kind of, you know, my God, what are you doing in this place? Because people couldn't be asked to sell their home. Well, I guess they could, but it began to create some problems, and we need, in the event this was to move forward, we certainly need that. It's not strictly low-income people, for goodness sakes. The park in Scappoose that Bob's talking about, those people are very well off financially, and they've worked like dogs, as Bob well knows, to get this thing through. But the only way that any of them go back to our park, when we finally had to give up on it and not be able to buy it, this charming lady from California bought it, and she signed the papers on the 29th of June, and on the 1st of July, we got an increase of $20 a month. The next year, we got one just exactly like it. We're not to the end of June yet, so I don't know what's going to happen this year. But our park is primarily single widows who are living on Social Security. And the reference was made some years back that people in the 50s, their Social Security wasn't much, and that's all too true. We've come up with a demographic study that one of the people in Bob's Housing Community Services put together on a demographic study, and I'll tell you, it's enough to make your hair stand on end. So something like this is terribly important, and I would be happy to work in any way I can with the representative to see if we can't move something like this through, because it's important. Thank you.
I'm going to need to have you hurry, because what I want to do is go back to our 5029 and to move the portions that we have agreement on.
Mr. Chairman, I thought I might add into the committee members, and the representatives have proposed amendments where he references park lots also. If you recall, last session you approved a bill that allowed tenants to purchase their own lots if the owner of the park chose to condominiumize or PUD the subdivision. And that reference that might have been picked up in here is because of that. Now, I contend, quite frankly, it's something not to just discount, because actually you give the potential of the use of the resource two ways, where you might have a group of park residents who want to buy it in a kind of a larger scale, or you might want to have that where a park owner says, I would like to condominiumize it, but there's no resources to find money to let them buy their land underneath their trailer. Now, if they were able to buy their, the manufactured house, if they did have that resource, or we were able to manage that resource, they then could finance their house like anybody else can, because they own the asset of the property along with the dwelling. So, I'm not saying that, I think that what you picked up, Senator, is correct, but it could be a combination of parks and or lots, which probably would work very well in the climate of what we've set up via the bill last session.
Thank you for being here.
And Mr. Chair, my closing comment is especially in reference to Senator Carter's comments, I really don't care how we get this done, where we come up with the money or how we divide it up and what rules that we come up with. I think we need to do this. I think it's the right thing to do. We are a wealthy society. We are we do have money coming to us, and again, I'm talking about a one-time appropriation here only, not something that currently that would go ongoing biennial. But again, I'm open to any concepts or ideas that the chair, members of the committee, or Bob, or anyone else might have how to make this happen. I think we need to move forward as a policy issue, and we ought to get this done. So, thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative, for being here. At this time, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3276, and we're going to reopen the work session on House Bill 5029. It's my intention to go ahead and move policy package 150 through 158, leaving unresolved 003. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chairman. Like to move policy packages 150. I'm looking for my number, Mr. Chairman. 150, was it?
150.
Yes, 150, got it. And the policy packages, another adjustment, starting with package 150, including packages through 158, no recommendations, LFO recommendations.
Okay. Will be pointed out that that will be policy package 150, 151, 152, 153, 154, 156, 157, and 158. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Any question about that issue? I'm going to stall just a little bit. Representative Smith wanted to vote on this, and so if you wouldn't mind, shall we stand at ease for about 2 or 3 minutes and see if we mix it out? Okay. No, we're not standing at ease. And we have a question.
Just a question. If we could give unanimous consent to allow Representative Smith to
vote later,
I'm prepared to move it now. And we're going to be coming back to this anyway.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter.
Oh. We move unanimous consent to both Representative Smith and Senator
Carter to vote. Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. Without objection.
And do we need a separate motion to vote on?
No, we have that motion, Senator Carter. Okay, we have the exception for the voting of Senator Dukes and Representative Smith. So at this time, then, we're going to vote on the policy packages 150 through 158.
That's right.
Without objection. So moved. At this time, we are running late on time, so we will, in fact, close the work session of House Bill 5029 with a tap of the gavel. Will also be adjourned.